When we read scripture, we paint a picture in our mind that helps us relate to what we're reading. A couple of weeks ago, we heard in the sermon of Balaam and the donkey, very much a personal favourite of mine as a child, and yet hearing it again as an adult, and that image is still there. Today, I would like to look at a very well-known scripture, one that too paints a picture in our minds when we read it, and then hopefully add a bit of detail to that picture. The scripture in question can be found in Revelation 11. Right at the beginning, Revelation 11 and verse 1. And there was given me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel stood, saying, Rise and measure the temple of God, and the altar, and them that worship therein. At its simplest, this paints the picture of a man walking around, a very simple structure with a ruler counting out aloud 13, 14, 15. Was that 15 or 14? Going back, measuring. And then perhaps writing something down and then doing the same the other way just to make sure. But as we'll hopefully go on to see, there is a lot more we can add to this picture because the implications for us of this scripture are quite profound. First, let's look at some of the definitions of words used. A reed, literally a stick of a fixed length, used for measuring length, what we would today call a rule or a ruler. The word measure is translated from the Greek metrio, which is Strong's number 3354, which means to ascertain in size by a fixed standard. That's where the word meter came from. The Cambridge Dictionary extends this definition by adding, to judge the quality, effect, or value of something. To put it another way, to assess something for compliance to a standard. The first time this word is used is in Matthew 7 verse 1. I'll just read it. It says, Judge not that you be not judged, for with what judgment you judge, you shall be judged, and with what measure ye metrio, it shall be measured to you again. So while literally it means to ascertain the size of the temple, it could also be taken as check the temple that it complies to the required standard. In the context of a building, the constant assessing process is essential, as the slightest mistake can prove to not only be expensive, but also dangerous. A few months ago, there was an article in several of the national newspapers which highlighted the importance of this process. The article reads, The owners of 5 £1 million luxury mansions face seeing their dream moorland homes demolished because they were built in the wrong places and are slightly too big. The 6-bedroom stone-built homes were built on a stunning plot in the West Pennine Moors, not far from Bolton in Lancashire, having been bought off plan after the proposal was given the go-ahead back in 2014. But works were halted when it was discovered 3 of the homes had not been built exactly in accordance with the approved planning permission. 2 of the buildings on the site had been put in different positions than those agreed, making the total footprint of the proposal much larger, while 1 home was 10 centimetres, about 4 inches, higher than permitted. Council bosses initially demanded that just the 3 houses be demolished, but the developer stuck with its own plan, leading to an enforcement notice being issued, ordering that the whole site be razed. It still goes on. On the other hand, there was another development that had to be demolished because the site itself hadn't been fully assessed before building work commenced. According to a local paper, a council has been forced to tear down 4 brand new homes which cost nearly £1 million to build. The unoccupied houses were razed to the ground after it was discovered they had been built on top of a burning coal seam which had flooded the properties with potentially deadly carbon monoxide. Apparently a further survey, which was specified as a building condition of the original planning consent, hadn't been carried out. And the end result was that the entire building project had to be demolished. So just from these examples, you can see how important it is to stick to the plans. And one of the key elements in doing that is regular assessments and checks of the building according to those plans. 4 inches too high might seem a bit over the top to have a £1 million house demolished, but as we'll go on to see, for the building we're looking at, the tolerances are a lot tighter. If we go back to Revelation 11 again, and let's look a bit more at the context. It says, as we read, there was given to me a great reed, and the angel stood, saying, "Rise and measure the temple of God and the altar, and them that worship therein." So the temple being measured is the temple of God. In a sermon titled "The Church in Prophecy," which was given in Chicago, March 28, 1981, Mr. Armstrong explained about this temple that Christ would return to. Now, the church is a nation. The church is a family. And a family relationship, the household of God. Now, notice what else the church is. Ephesians 2:20, "And are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets." He interjects, "You build a building of stone, of wood, and of materials like that on a foundation." Now notice he's talking about a building now. This is, and then he quotes from Ephesians 2, verses 20, 21. "On the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building fitly framed together groweth into a holy temple." Now the building becomes a holy spiritual temple. "That, my brethren, is the temple to which Christ is coming. Did you think maybe the Jews were going to tear down the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem and build a temple for Jesus? Oh no, he's not coming to a physical temple. He's coming to a temple that will excel Solomon's temple by far in glory." Well, the temple that Zerubbabel built didn't excel Solomon's temple in glory. But Christ, the second time, is coming to a temple that will. Now, what temple is he coming to? He's coming to the church. That is the glorious temple to which Christ is coming. We are to rise to meet him in the air as he's coming, and his feet will stand on that day on the Mount of Olives. He's talking about the church. Now, Zerubbabel built the temple to which Christ came the first time. He was a type, a forerunner, of someone to build the spiritual temple, the church, to which Christ is coming the second time. Brethren, you are that temple. That ought to thrill you clear from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet. If we carry on reading from Revelation 11 again, and let's look a bit more at the timing. From verse 2, it says, "But the court which is without the temple leave out, and measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months, which is 3.5 years. And I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the God of the earth." We know that the time is come, the judgment must begin at the house of God, as is put in 1 Peter 4:17. But it would appear that this assessment takes place shortly before the two witnesses are revealed, around the same time that Philadelphia is separated from Laodicea, about 3.5 years before Christ's return. Just a few pages back, in chapter 3 of Revelation, Christ says of Philadelphia in verse 12, "Him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out, and I will write upon him the name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which cometh down out of heaven from my God, and I will write upon him my new name." It could be that it is this assessment that determines whether the pillars are ready and fit for purpose before they are taken to a place of safety to protect them from the great tribulation. In any construction, there are phases. First, the foundations are laid. Then the structural elements are added, in this case the pillars. Then the rest of the building can be built around these pillars. And then finally, the landscaping. The temple that Christ is in the process of preparing now will be built in a similar way. The foundations have been long been laid down by the prophets and the apostles, including the understanding of prophecy as revealed through Mr. Armstrong. And then the pillars will be selected, and finally the rest of the temple will be assembled upon Christ's return. And then, if there is one thing that the millennium is going to be, it's going to be the greatest landscaping project the world has ever seen. In the quote I read earlier from Mr. Armstrong, he said that Christ will be coming to a temple that will excel Solomon's temple by far in glory, and that the church is that glorious temple. So let's just briefly have a look at some of the details of Solomon's temple. Paint another picture. We'll read some of the details as given in 1 Kings, but there are further details also given in 2 Chronicles. First, Solomon prepared a great workforce, as detailed in 1 Kings 5. And what a workforce it was. 30,000 men working on the timber. 80,000 men to hew the stone. 70,000 to carry all the materials. And then over 3,000 foremen to oversee them. And then in chapter 6 of 1 Kings, he starts building. 1 Kings 6, starting verse 2. And the house which King Solomon built for the Eternal, the length thereof was 80 cubits, and the breadth thereof 20 cubits, the height thereof 30 cubits, and the porch before the temple of the house, 20 cubits was the length thereof, according to the breadth of the house, and 10 cubits was the breadth thereof before the house. And for the house he made windows of narrow lights, and against the wall of the house he built chambers around about, against the walls of the house round about, both of the temple and of the oracle, and he made chambers around about. The nethermost chamber was 5 cubits broad, and the middle was 6 cubits broad. The third was 7 cubits. There are a lot of quite precise measurements here, and Solomon was most thorough in sticking to them. There was no fear of the temple being 4 inches too high. Carrying on in verse 6. For without in the wall of the house he made narrowed rests around about, that the beams should not be fastened in the walls of the house. And the house, when it was in building, was built of stone, made ready before it was brought thither, so that there was neither hammer nor axe, nor any tool of iron heard in the house while it was in building. It's interesting to note that the stones were prepared off-site to avoid the use of iron tools. I've often wondered why. Could it be just to serve as an example for us to look back on now and understand that we are all being fashioned individually, off-site, ready to be fitted, fitly framed together? Or is there perhaps more to it? Solomon was blessed with exceptional wisdom. He was also very much focused on getting things right. He was an all-or-nothing kind of guy. He knew that his father, King David, wanted to build the temple, but was prohibited by God from doing so, and that God had said that his son Solomon would build it instead. He was now the king, so he would have known the law. He would have written his own copy of it to keep with him and to read from daily, as per Deuteronomy 17:18. So he would have known what God had said in his law about building altars. Just put in your notes Exodus 20 and verse 25. And if thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it out of hewn stone, for if thou lift up thy tool upon it, thou hast polluted it. Solomon was very fervent with his desire to build a house for God, and he threw everything he had at it. Dropping down a bit now to verse 19 of 1 Kings 6. And the oracle he prepared in the house within, to set there the ark of the covenant of the Eternal. And the oracle in the forepart was 20 cubits in length, and 20 cubits in breadth, and 20 cubits in the height thereof. And he overlaid it with pure gold, and so covered the altar, which was of cedar. So Solomon overlaid the house within with pure gold. And he made a partition by the chains of gold before the oracle, and he overlaid it with gold. And the whole house he overlaid with gold, until he had finished all the house. Also the whole altar that was by the oracle was overlaid with gold. He then had 2 identical cherubims made out of olive wood. And then in verse 28, he overlaid the cherubims with gold. In chapter 7, we see details of the two pillars for the front of the temple. These were not only an engineering marvel, they were a thing of immense beauty. They would have been about 14 and a half metres or 47 and a half foot tall, about 2 metres or 6.5 foot in diameter, made out of cast brass. The pillars on their own would have made for a glorious looking temple, so the sight of the whole temple must have been hard to describe. The quality of the craftsmanship was immense. The tolerances were, it's either perfect or it's wrong. No, we'll leave that for the plasterer to cover up. Or, don't worry about that flaw in the wood, it's going to be covered in gold anyway, so you won't see it. In order to achieve this level of physical perfection, there must have been constant measuring and checking for compliance, starting long before the parts ever even made it to the site. And yet Christ will be coming to a temple that will excel Solomon's temple by far in glory. It stands to reason then that we too need to be constantly assessed to make sure that we are fit for purpose. So next time we read Revelation 11, especially verse 1, try and picture those two massive brass pillars at the front of the temple, because that's closer to our destiny. And rather than a site surveyor just measuring the size of the temple, think of it as Christ checking that the pillars are ready, fit for purpose and inclusion in that most glorious temple. It might be a hard picture to paint, to see how a small group of people scattered around the world with our various personal problems could ever come close to comparing with the splendour of Solomon's temple. But remember, it is God that will glorify his temple. As Mr. Armstrong said, "Brethren, you are that temple. That ought to thrill you clear from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet."